Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we'll hear from people who are switching careers, including former coal miners who are learning computer programming.
Our slogan is a new day, a new way, and it's a new day here in Appalachia, and we're trying to do things a new way.
And we'll hear from non-traditional students who've graduated from college thanks to a job training program in Virginia.
This has to be the most exhilarating moment of my life. My mom turns 50 on the 29th of this month, and I can actually hand her for her birthday my paper saying that I finished college.
And we'll meet the next person in our Struggle to Stay series, a mother of two named Crystal Snyder.
Is it a good idea for me to leave my children here? Like, part of me wants to take them out so they don't die 15 years, you know, premature. But just as much of me wants to fight for them because this place is so beautiful.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. The job market is changing. On today's show, we're going to explore how some Appalachians are adapting to new jobs and how some traditional jobs are evolving. We start off with the latest episode of our Struggle to Stay series, where we'll meet 37-year-old Crystal Snyder, who, among other jobs, has one of the oldest jobs there is, being a mother. Crystal is a single mother of two who says she wants to stay in Appalachia, where her family has lived for hundreds of years. But it's been a challenge to pay all her bills and find employment that she enjoys, all while being a single mom. Aside from financial stress, Crystal sometimes asks herself whether raising two kids in West Virginia is good for their health. Roxy Todd has the first story that helps explain Crystal's struggle to stay.
Fifteen years ago, Crystal Snyder's mom was diagnosed with advanced lung cancer, which had already spread to the rest of her body. She died a few weeks later when Crystal was just 22 years old.
When you see a map and it shows you, like, this area of poverty, people die 15, 20 years younger than they do over here in Virginia, and your mother died at 41, and that kind of makes you think, like, is it a good idea for me to leave my children here? Like, part of me wants to take them out so they don't die 15 years, you know, premature.
Crystal has blonde hair, and her face is tanned from working in the sun. On her back, she has a tattoo of a fiddle. Actually, the tattoo covers up the name of her second husband, a marriage that was a mistake, she says. She's made other decisions she isn't proud of, but being a mom isn't something she regrets.
My kids and I, we have a good bond. It's not been easy.
Crystal married early, when she was 16. She had her son Aaron a year later, and her daughter Morgan when she was in her 20s.
I just want to cherish these moments, you know, because he's in 11th grade, and he's 18, and she's almost 12, and I know that it's not going to last long, you know? So, and I am single, and it's just us, and I'm just like, trying to relish in these moments, you know, because I know I'll look back and remember, you know, years down the road, just this important time, you know, that we had together. And I love them.
Crystal recorded this next entry at her home while she was cooking dinner with her daughter Morgan, who has bright red hair. While they cook, Morgan tells her mom about an episode of MacGyver.
What happened?
Morgan says she hopes she'll soon be taller than her mom. At nearly 5 feet, she's close. Crystal smiles at her daughter.
She's independent. She's been independent since she was like four. Like she would never let me brush her hair or pick out her clothes. She always did it on her own. Like, I wanted to. She's got beautiful red hair, you know, and she wouldn't even let me brush it. But she just developed like her own style, you know, and I'm glad we did that because she knows a lot.
While they're cooking, Morgan records her mom secretly while she's singing Hank Williams.
How's about cooking something up with me?
I recorded that.
If
Then Crystal goes to tell her son, Aaron, that dinner is almost ready.
Oh my God, you got the bird out. Holy moly. Okay.
The family's parrot, Sunny, is perched on Aaron's shoulder. He puts the bird in its cage and joins Crystal and Morgan at the dinner table.
It's daylight. So tell me what you're eating there after you chew that up.
Crystal and her daughter are both vegetarians. Aaron prefers to eat meat, and Crystal often cooks him pork tenderloin in the crock pot.
I know. I'm proud of myself because I keep a house and it's not hard and I'm usually in the negative. But somehow, I don't know how, I keep it going. I just somehow always find a way. I don't give up.
There were some scary things that happened to Crystal when she was a little girl. She remembers late night parties with strangers coming into their house, drug deals at the home, and fights between her parents.
It was total neglect, but my mom, like, you know, she had been abused as a child, and it was just turmoil. No, she loved us, but no, they didn't know how to take care of kids. It was neglect and abuse, and I was an accident, and they weren't going to have me. I don't know the exact story. Either she was too far along or she saw my heartbeat and decided not to have an abortion. But so I'm really lucky to be here. So I wasn't even two, and my mom and dad were fighting. Like, they fought constantly. So my mom kicked my dad out and said to take me too.
As a girl, Crystal moved back and forth from her grandparents' house, her mom's, and her dad's. Her parents broke up and got back together several times. Her dad was in and out of prison for most of her childhood, serving time for selling drugs.
Well, I used to call the mailbox Dad, so I was like a baby, like before I remember the first time. I mean, I remember going to the Cabell County Courthouse where the old jail was, and like, I drive by there now and I just think, that's where I went to see my dad, you know?
And then Crystal's mom met a guy at a truck stop, left with him, and never looked back. Crystal was just 15. She only saw her mom a few times after that.
She'd come back and visit, and she'd say, I'll never live here again. You know, I'm not coming back. And I don't know. I thought she was brave for that, but I wanted her close.
Around this time, Crystal decided she wanted a family and kids of her own.
I wanted like a stable family. I wanted, I guess, people to care about and people that cared about me.
Hoping her children are safe and healthy is what weighs heaviest on her mind. And as much as she loves West Virginia, she sometimes worries whether staying is good for their health.
But just as much of me wants to fight for them because this place is so beautiful and I just feel really blessed to live here and I should be able to live here with clean water. And I think the part of me that wants to fight to stay here is stronger than the mother in me that wants to get my kids out of here so they see happy people and, you know, I don't know, it's sad. Huntington, I love Huntington. That's where I was born and raised, but like you go there and everybody's so skinny and they're, you know, like their teeth, like you can just tell there's like so much desperation. It breaks my heart.
But the fight isn't the only reason why Crystal wants to stay in West Virginia.
I love to travel. I love to see new places. But nothing compares to West Virginia, I don't think. It's just not home. Like, you know, if you see just like flat, like you can see too far, it's like, this isn't right.
And although Crystal doesn't have a lot of family here, she does have a sister who's a year older. And having that tie is important, especially getting to see their two daughters grow up together. One evening last summer, they came to Crystal's house to cook dinner and play.
Hey, Morgan. You should go outside and play for a little while before the sun sets. Okay, cool.
It had been raining all day. As Crystal and her sister were cooking in the kitchen, the sun peeked through the clouds, and Crystal noticed her niece, Olivia, and her daughter, Morgan, dancing and running in the rain.
Oh, so the girls, it's...
I bet there's a rainbow.
There probably is a rainbow. The sun is shining, and we see our daughters, Morgan and Olivia, out here playing in the rain. In the mud, oh my goodness, halfway up their legs. How are you going to get that off of you? Because you can't go in the house.
Rain.
Out back, the water hose sprayed off. Clean your mess up. Thank you very much. Please be careful. Do you see a rainbow?
It's moments like these that make Crystal want to stay, to raise her kids in the mountains. So she's going to continue to try to live here and to make West Virginia better and safer.
What are you most proud of? My tenacity. I'm proud that I shine my light still, maybe more so than if I hadn't experienced darkness.
I first met Crystal in January of 2016 in the middle of a major life change. She'd recently been laid off from her job at a nearby t-shirt factory. We'll hear more on that next time. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd in Cabell County, West Virginia.
We'll hear the next part of Crystal Snyder's struggle to stay story next week here on Inside Appalachia. Up next, if you can't beat them, program them. Coal miners are finding they already have some of the skills needed to learn robotics and even computer programming. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Today on Inside Appalachia, we're looking at how the job market is affecting people in Appalachia. Next, we'll look at how some laid-off miners are switching careers. Machines have been taking the coal miner's job for years. But hey, somebody's got to program those computers and machines. Although the coal industry has experienced a modest uptick in production since last fall, that's production and not necessarily jobs. Economists still predict a steady downfall for coal employment in Appalachia over the next few decades. As a way to transition to steadier work in technology fields, some coal miners are learning to become code workers, as Erica Peterson of WFPL reports.
All over eastern Kentucky, you see cars and pickup trucks with black license plates proclaiming the owner is a friend of coal. Even though the license plates are all over, it's getting harder to find actual coal miners here. Fewer than 6,000 remain. Many have had to leave the area to find work, but a few have found employment in other, and sometimes unexpected, fields.
Realization I had was that the coal miner, although we think of him as a person who gets dirty and works with his hands, really coal miners today are very sophisticated, and they use a lot of technology, a lot of robotics.
Rusty Justice is one of the owners of BitSource, a year-old tech startup in Pikeville. He owns another company in eastern Kentucky, too, an engineering and excavation firm that relies on the coal industry for most of its business. But with an eye on his bottom line, a few years ago, Justice felt he had to diversify. And after lots of research, he and his business partner settled on coding, tapping the region's workforce of laid-off coal miners and teaching them a new skill. He put up ads and got close to 1,000 applicants. 10 were hired and 9 remain. Inside BitSource's headquarters, the 9 web developers sit around MacBooks writing code. All of them used to work in the coal industry. And after 22 weeks of company-provided training, 6 former coal miners and 3 industry support workers became coders.
I'm Garland Couch, and I'm a developer here at BitSource.
Couch used to be a maintenance manager for coal companies until he lost his job in 2014. Like most coal industry jobs, his paid well. Before he got the call from BitSource, Couch says he figured he'd have to leave the region to support his family.
The entire Appalachian area, if you're not working in the coal industry, then the wage that you're going to make is substantially reduced. If you're going to earn a decent living, then you're having to look to move.
Eastern Kentuckians value family and the area, and they want to stay home, and they should be able to do that. And I think that's our goal as policymakers, to ensure that they can.
State Senator Robin Webb represents several eastern Kentucky counties and is a former coal miner turned lawyer. In the past, politicians focused on improving the region's asphalt infrastructure, building 2- and 4-lane highways to eastern Kentucky. They blamed the struggling economy on the topography, mountains and forests that necessitated spiderweb networks of long, winding roads. But now, BitSource manager John Hanshew says for companies like his to thrive, eastern Kentucky needs a different type of infrastructure.
We aren't shipping coal out of here anymore, we're shipping code. And the broadband's our highway, you know, our shipping lanes, our trains.
The region's internet speeds lag when compared to most other cities, though a state-funded project is working to bring broadband to the region. Leaders in the area see the project as crucial to creating a new Appalachia. For them, the future of the region relies on lots of smaller industries and employers, rather than one gigantic one like the coal industry. It's a big change from the way things were done in the past. BitSource owner Rusty Justice points to the old-fashioned mine equipment hanging in the building's entry.
Our slogan is a new day, a new way, and it's a new day here in Appalachia, and we're trying to do things a new way.
And as Justice says, it's not necessarily a new way for the rest of the world, but it's new for eastern Kentucky. For NPR News, I'm Erica Peterson.
That story originally aired on NPR's All Things Considered in May of 2016. This next story is about the shifting job market in the power industry. Despite the Trump administration's support for the coal industry, the power sector is moving toward more use of natural gas. The switch is also happening in central Appalachia, where coal has long been king, with big implications for the region's economy and environment. Glynis Board reports on two facilities that illustrate the power struggle that's taking place in the midst of the energy switch.
Secretary of the Department of Energy Rick Perry recently toured North America's youngest, most efficient coal-fired electricity plant, Longview Power, in West Virginia.
This is a very enlightening stop. This technology, this ability to deliver a secure, an economical, and an environmentally good source of energy is really important.
20 days' worth of coal is always stockpiled at the plant, fed directly from the mouth of a nearby coal mine via a 4.5-mile-long conveyor belt. About 600 employees work together to keep rock burning hot, to boil water, to make steam, which turns a turbine, creating 700 megawatts of electricity for the region. It's also really loud. Longview manager Chad Huffnagel led a tour through the facility.
This is the turbine building. This is where we take the steam from the boiler, and we rotate the turbine in order to take the mechanical energy into electrical.
Secretary Perry and many federal lawmakers see big benefits in keeping coal-fired power going. But not many new coal power plants are slated for construction, if any. Plans were drawn for Longview in 2001. It was financed in 2007 and turned on for the first time in 2011. A couple years later, it went bankrupt. But after reorganization, the Trump administration considers Longview the best example of clean coal in the U.S., even though it doesn't capture carbon emissions, which is something generally thought of as part of clean coal technology.
The people who make their living in the coal mines, running plants like this, they have a friend, a proponent in the White House and Donald Trump.
But coal is getting old. The average age of coal plants in the U.S. today is about 40 years. Even with relaxed federal regulations on coal-fired power plants, 8,000 megawatts of additional coal power are expected to be retired this year. That's like 11 Longviews. And 13,000 megawatts were retired last year, and many of those before planned retirement dates. Fleets of new natural gas power plants are in the works. Three are pending in West Virginia, a dozen in Ohio, and in Kentucky, one of the largest electricity utilities in the country, Tennessee Valley Authority, just celebrated shifting half of its largest electricity plant from coal to gas. President and CEO Bill Johnson addressed a crowd gathered in Paradise, Kentucky.
It's a big part of our priority here to diversify our fleet to make sure that we are making electricity at the lowest feasible rate.
Directly behind me is the new Paradise Combined Cycle facility, and it's co-located with the unit down the hill, which is part of our Paradise Coal facility.
That's Senior Vice President of Power Operations, David Sorek. He says the new TVA natural gas facility cost $1 billion.
Natural gas is more flexible, it's cheaper to operate, and it's also more efficient.
It also produces 40 to 50% of the carbon emissions compared to the coal unit, and no mercury, and a lot less soot. And that might translate, believe it or not, to fatter babies in the region.
And there's a backwards old town that's often remembered so many times.
Paradise became a household name thanks to John Prine's ballad about the costs of coal extraction.
Down by the Green River where paradise lay. Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away.
But what Prine couldn't see were a lot of the health effects of burning coal, effects that would take years to observe. The TVA has been burning coal just outside of Paradise for 50 years, but it started burning a lot more in the 80s, as researcher from Carnegie Mellon University, Edson Severnini, noticed.
It was completely related to the Three Mile Island partial meltdown in 79, and that triggered this substitution between nuclear and fossil fuel.
TVA retired some of its nuclear generators in the wake of the disaster, replacing them with coal. That swap in the mid-80s provided Severnini opportunity to study public health impacts in places where coal power generation increased, places like Paradise.
There was a huge increase in coal-fired power generation, a high increase in air pollution, and in that particular location, there was a decrease in birth weight by 5.4%.
He looked at recorded birth weight in the first 18 months after the region's switch to coal. It was accessible data, and apparently birth weight is a reliable indicator of human health outcomes later in life. Low birth weight can be linked to shorter lifespans, higher susceptibility to diseases, even a person's ability to thrive socially. Severnini published his findings in the journal Nature in April.
What I wanted people to think about is, what are the consequences of energy choices?
No matter how you burn it, coal is an organic material and will produce emissions. Recent studies indicate soot from coal power plants account for about 7,000 premature deaths each year in the U.S., which is a lot fewer than we used to see.
The cleaner you get that carbon-containing compound you're burning, the better it is.
That's physician and public health expert at the University of Pittsburgh, Dr. Bernard Goldstein.
And there are cleaner forms of coal, but none of them are as clean as, say, natural gas.
Goldstein says despite a lack of data to understand the health impacts of the natural gas industry as a whole, it is a significantly cleaner fossil fuel to burn.
Anytime that we've had areas which have gone switched from coal to natural gas, there are far less particulates in the air, and so the pollution levels have decreased because of that switch.
Goldstein says the gas industry has missed opportunities to address its own environmental effects, including pollution near drilling sites as well as waste disposal concerns. As a result, any health effects remain to be clearly understood.
But for natural gas, the major uncertainties play on the people who live next door.
Next door to gas drilling, that is. In other words, any long-term health and environmental effects will likely take years to observe, and the people of the Ohio Valley will likely bear the brunt of those effects, just as they have with coal.
Well, they dug for their coal till the land was forsaken. Then they rode it all down as the progress of man.
For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Glynis Board in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Down by the Green River where paradise lay.
Support for the Ohio Valley Resource comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
When I die, let my ashes float down the Green River. Let my soul roll on up to the Rochester Dam. I'll be halfway to heaven.
Next, we travel to Virginia, where a nonprofit called Plug In Virginia helps prepare adult learners for high-tech factory jobs. After all, nowadays in factories, people don't really make stuff. Machines do. But again, somebody has to know how to operate those machines. The program teaches students at community colleges across Virginia. Let's listen now to two recent graduates of the program.
My name is Christopher O'Neill Morris, Sr. This has to be the most exhilarating moment of my life. My mom turns 50 on the 29th of this month, and I can actually hand her for her birthday my paper saying that I finished college. So she can breathe easy and know that I'm not doing a lot of the things that I used to do. In this class, like, I actually learned that I am able to learn. Like, as funny as it sounds, it's just like, you know how you get to a certain age, being here has actually taught me that you should never stop learning. Like, I used to feel like there's no way possible I could be a journalist. But now I understand that I really still can. You know what I mean? Like, sometimes you get so far away from your dreams that you don't even remember that they exist. So me being in this class is really kind of like I'm dreaming once again. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't feel as if the world is against me. I really feel like a part of the world now. So it's really just been a way to, I guess, make my life a lot safer, a lot easier, and actually give my kids somebody they can look up to. So as opposed to telling them, do as I say and not as I do, like, now I can actually be an example for them to follow.
My name is Savon Jones. I'm 24 years old. All my life, I always wanted a career. I was like, here I am working two jobs, taking care of two kids. And I was like, this is not enough. The first couple of months, I was still working two jobs and going to school. So I was doubling up on the days I didn't have school. I had school Tuesday, Thursday, starting off. So Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, I'd be working. It wasn't easy. I mean, a lot of times I wanted to give up, but looking at my situation, got kids watching me, got a lot of people counting on me, I wasn't just going to give up like that. I just wasn't going to do it. So I just stayed with it until I got in the middle of the program and I realized that I can't keep going at rate and expect to succeed. I sacrificed one of my jobs. I really didn't want to, but I did it so I could finish the program. And it was hard because I was short a lot of money. Like, I was just barely making all my bills. It's been a hard year. My background, it makes things more harder for me. I got to work twice as hard as the average man, I feel like, because of my background, because of prior mistakes I've made, which is my fault on my decisions. So I just kept on pushing. And I was all in, no question. And up to this day, I have not missed a day of the whole year of school, no matter what. Tired, sick, hungry, broke, it doesn't matter. I was coming to class to succeed.
That was Savon Jones and Christopher O'Neill, two men who graduated college in 2016 through a program called Plugged In Virginia. Their teacher was Marcy Gale, who teaches students at Central Virginia Community College. She spoke with Sarah McConnell, host of the show With Good Reason, about why getting an education past high school is increasingly important, even for manufacturing jobs.
Back in the 70s, you could graduate high school, you could walk into a Ford plant or whatever and instantly make a good living, a living that you could support an entire family on. You can't do that anymore. Those jobs are not here. You either have a four-year degree and you get, you know, a hoity-toity job, or you go flip burgers and there's not a lot in between. And the manufacturing jobs in today's world are different. You have to know computer skills. You have to have some business acumen. You have to be aware of OSHA regulations. You have to know how to control meters. So a lot of businesses now are requiring even applicants to have some of these industry certifications. They will not look at your application unless you have this certification already.
What were you teaching them? You're teaching them some technical skills, but also life skills.
Yeah, it's something I try to do in all of my classes. I teach math and computer science and engineering and electronics, but I find that all of the concepts are applicable to life in general. And the class that I taught these guys was called troubleshooting. And what is life but troubleshooting constantly? And so we started out the class by talking about troubleshooting life and teamwork and how you have to accept that annoying person that you're going to have to work with on the job, but work through the issues.
You teach so many classes, but the one that we're talking about in particular, where you have people who've gone through the prison system, how do they know that your class even exists? Who finds them?
They came through as a cohort, and they were shepherded through by some representatives from the nonprofit PIVA, Plugged in Virginia, that initiated the program and vetted the applicants to come up with the cohort of students.
Do you know what sort of criminal records they have typically?
There were felons, but most of them were nonviolent. I mean, I did not feel anything but love and happiness from them the whole class. They were, minor drug charges and that sort of thing.
By the time you got them, could you see that actually they were enormously capable? They just missed out the first time.
Oh, absolutely. And I see this all the time. I teach mostly adults. And this is why I love what I do, because I teach people who have figured out that they need to get this done to move their life forward. They need to understand, not just sit through a class because the state says you have to. It's wonderful to teach people that are motivated and engaged and interested.
What do you think the role of community colleges is in this regard?
The role of community colleges is to be that interface for a large portion of the population that don't need to get a four-year degree, that maybe can't afford to get a four-year degree, and aren't sure that they want a four-year degree. It used to be called vocational education. You know, it was home ec, and it was wood shop or auto shop or whatever. And there was a stigma attached to it. You know, it was for the kids that can't quite make it in college. This is what you'll do instead, go to cosmetology school. Those things do still exist, but there is now this place in the middle that is between old school vocational education and a four-year college degree.
What are those jobs in the gap?
If you walk into a factory, you're not wrapping up a widget or sticking a button on something going by on a conveyor belt. You're running a robot. You are programming a computer to cut a piece of metal in a certain shape. Or you're interfacing lots of different systems to produce the final product. And most of these systems are complicated. They're complicated machines. They're dangerous machines. They're precise machines. They need maintenance. They need programming. They need adjustments that you can't just do walking in off the street. You've got to understand what a meter is, how to use it.
What can you see from your vantage point when it comes to the vast swath of America and the jobs landscape? Are there whole areas where these industries don't even exist? No matter how much STEM education we give people, there just aren't jobs to receive them. What are some of the intractable challenges that we're going to have to overcome now?
You know, in the current political environment, you hear much about, I'm going to create millions of jobs. Well, the jobs that we used to have, they're not going to exist anymore. There are no more buggy whip factories. We've moved on. I just heard a story yesterday about two guys that are inventing robots. They're teaching the robots how to sew. If they accomplish it, you can have a whole factory. We can bring sewing manufacturing back to the United States like we used to have. But instead of 300 people working in that factory, you're going to have maybe 30 programming the robots, adjusting them for the new garment coming through, maintaining them. The old factory job of sewing is now running a robot.
You know, Germany has done vocational education to perfection for years. America doesn't so much, but we also have a philosophical difference. We don't want to say, when you go through high school, we're going to decide in fourth grade that you aren't college material. So we've not embraced vocational education. How do you get past that? How do you both tell every student, you can reach the moon if you want, but also we're going to give you a fantastic, highly skilled technical education if you want it?
One reason I do love teaching at the community college is because it's the land of second chances. And people that come there are quite often coming after some gap. They went to high school, they fooled around, they didn't pay attention, whatever. They got out and they went through the school of hard knocks at that point. Now they've got a child or two, or they're married. And now they're going to get serious. Now they understand in order to get a job, they have to have some skills. They've been on that street trying to get these jobs, and they found out they can't get them. There's too much competition. There's, 200 applications for a manufacturing technician position. And unless your resume has this certification on it, yours is going to the bottom.
And so do you think that we ought to really ramp up our high school vocational education programs?
I think what the high schools need to do is work at coming closer to someone being job ready when they graduate. And they need to do that by exposing the students to the various categories. You know, there's healthcare, there's manufacturing, there's the finance, there's small business. Rather than just saying, here's a math class, here's algebra. We don't know what you'll ever use algebra for, but you have to learn it. Students these days are more focused. They don't want to waste their time. They want to know that something they're learning is going to be of use to them. And I'm a big advocate of not teaching math as a separate subject, incorporated into every other subject, which is what I love to do in my electronics classes, is pause, say, okay, now we're going to do math for 10 minutes, and here's why, and you plug it right into what you're learning, and boy, then does it stick.
Give me a taste of that kind of math, because I was never great in math.
Now, see, I would not allow you to say that in my class. What you're not allowed to say in my class is I'm not good at math. We start there. Then we talk about math anxiety, which is a thing. So I teach people math is your friend. Don't hate the math. It doesn't hate you. And I get excited about teaching math because it has a purpose. It's useful. So we're learning about inductors and capacitors and circuits. So you have to learn this special math skill, vector addition. And they probably learned it in algebra, but it meant nothing to them. And then you do it in the context of this is why on the oscilloscope screen this waveform looks like this, because look, we can verify it with the math on the board and the lights come on and it's a fabulous, exciting moment.
I know that this is the first year you've taught a class with students who've gone through the prison system. Even in this 1 year, has that given you a vision into how we're incarcerating people and what the gains, losses, minuses are?
Oh, I think our system is terrible. It sets people up for failure for the rest of their life.
But you learned that in 1 year?
Oh, in 5 minutes. Not long ago, the governor in our state restored voting rights to ex-felons who had served their time and finished their paroles. And I wish you could have seen the excitement of these guys when I told them about it. And several of them went out that day and registered. It was so such a wonderful moment for me. I wrote the governor. I said, thanks for letting me be your hug proxy.
Now, that didn't last long because the Supreme Court overturned his unilateral action.
And I warned them about that. However, I said I actually used it as a good example of troubleshooting and anticipating problems and having an alternate solution in the wings ready to go.
I'm so surprised that they cared one way or another. I would think that voting didn't matter that much to them.
They cared immensely, immensely. They felt double jeopardy. I did my time. I got out. I did my parole. I did everything society asked me to do to make up for this mistake I made, and yet I'm still being punished. Why? They didn't understand the logic of it.
Don't you know, though, that so many people listening to you think, well, I don't know. I mean, Felon, it's a little bit scary.
Felon is a random, it's random. Our laws are such that one thing we call a felony is not nearly as bad as what you can do in a different state, and the laws are different. Just my personal opinion, you know, a minor drug charge, nonviolent offender, tiny little bag of whatever, you know, you're in a desperate situation. Should you pay the rest of your life for a youthful mistake? I don't think so. I don't think we can expect society to move forward when we ask people who make mistakes to continue to pay for them. And I think it's random. We've all made mistakes. We've all done things that we wouldn't want to be publicly punished for, but we certainly don't want to pay for those mistakes for the rest of our lives.
That was Marcy Gale, who teaches with the Plugged In Virginia program at Central Virginia Community College. She was speaking with Sarah McConnell, host of With Good Reason. We hear a lot of rhetoric about job-killing regulations, but in some parts of coal country, a new job has evolved because of an environmental regulation.
It's a huge economy that requires specialized training, requires specialized people, and create high-paying jobs.
That's coming up next. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back. When President Donald Trump signed an executive order back in March to roll back Obama-era environmental rules, he surrounded himself with coal miners and returned to a familiar campaign theme, job-killing regulations.
With today's executive action, I am taking historic steps to lift the restrictions on American energy, to reverse government intrusion, and to cancel job-killing regulations.
But in some corners of coal country, an environmental regulation is creating jobs. Stream restoration is part of a multi-billion dollar business, and some displaced miners are tapping into that revenue stream. Glennis Board reports.
Hydrologist Ed Watson with the Canaan Valley Institute is in the business of fixing broken streams. And yes, it's a business. From the inside of his truck, Watson points to a hillside towering behind a shopping center in Logan County, West Virginia. His organization just finished restoring an entire watershed here. The project took 5 years.
So the watershed we're going into was mined pre-law, as they say.
What he means by pre-law is that this mountain was mined for coal before the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act, which requires companies to try to reclaim land.
We all decided that we could actually do something and possibly put some streams back where streams haven't flowed for 50 or 60 years.
Watson studied old topographical maps and clues in the land to figure out where streams here used to flow.
Our thought process was to try to rehook up the plumbing of the watershed. I'm not sure exactly what we can see from right here.
He points at a reconstructed hillside, a really steep one, with a small stream built in, complete with rocks, woody debris, and native trees and shrubs planted alongside.
So we built a stream that is as though it has sorted itself out, but in year one instead of year 10,000.
Watson was hired to design this project by a land restoration company that buys property to see it permanently restored. That company, Ecosystem Investment Partners, owns about 13 similar properties across the country, 70,000 acres in all. About 2,000 of these restored properties exist in the U.S. Land restoration companies get credit from federal agencies based on restoration accomplishments.
So you come back after 5 years and somebody assesses what the ecological value is based on a certain scoring mechanism, and then that credit is a commodity that can be bought and sold.
And while Watson does this kind of work because he loves improving the environment, he also loves a paycheck, and so do the contractors hired to turn his designs into reality.
Our basic business is a construction business that specializes in rebuilding streams and wetlands.
Chris White co-founded a company called Appalachian Stream Restoration about 13 years ago.
So you talked about how like people think of you as environmentalists. Do you consider yourselves environmentalists?
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think so. I prefer to think of myself as a capitalist.
White grew up in what he calls hit-or-miss coal mining. He now employs about 30 people, many of them displaced miners. They travel all over the region fixing broken streams with backhoes and other heavy machinery. He has a $2 million payroll annually. And according to the National Mitigation Banking Association, the ecological restoration industry as a whole creates $25 billion each year.
It's a huge economy that requires specialized training, requires specialized people, and create high-paying jobs.
And it's all possible because of the environmental regulations established 40 years ago in the Clean Water Act. Section 404 requires any developer that impairs wetlands or streams to fix similar systems in the affected area.
And while there's a lot of debate in scientific circles about stream mitigation and the science of restoration, as long as the Clean Water Act remains intact and land continues to be developed at the rate we see today, White and others restoring ecosystems expect to keep making bank, so to speak. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Glynis Board in Logan, West Virginia.
The job market is changing. It's always changing. Companies have to make money to survive, and business owners will look for ways to cut back on expenses. And unfortunately, one of the largest expense for a company is the people. But there was a time when working on the railroad was new, operating a high-wall machine was new. We as Americans used the new opportunities to surge into the future. But we couldn't do it if we held on to the past. We just adapted. Here in Appalachia, is the economy really as grim as people say? Have you switched careers or gone back to school? Have you found living in Appalachia to be a struggle financially? What have you found to help make ends meet? Send us a message. We'd love to hear your story. Send us a tweet to In Appalachia or write us. You can send an email to feedback@wvpublic.org or address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, the Southern Foodways Alliance, and the Ohio Valley Resource. Music in today's show was provided by Marisa Anderson, Dinosaur Burps, Andy James Reams and the Barnstormers, Dog and Gun, and Ben Townsend. The fiddle music you heard in today's show is from the archived field recordings at the Augusta Heritage Center. Today's show was produced by Roxy Todd. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. He also edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Claire Hemme helped with our digital correspondence. And again, you can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia or email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. And don't forget, the Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Downcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.